From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. A Republican in one of the most hotly contested Senate races this year is calling for Donald Trump to apologize for repeatedly criticizing the parents of a fallen soldier who criticized Trump at the Democratic National Convention last week. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson was on Midday with Charlie Sykes on WTMJ Radio this morning.
I can't imagine losing a child. I can't imagine that sacrifice. And so all you can do is respect it and honor it, and that's all you should do.
So what should Donald Trump do?
He should apologize.
He should apologize. Do you think he will apologize?
Probably not.
Why not?
We've been watching him.
Trump is also taking heat from party leaders for declining to endorse House Speaker Paul Ryan and Arizona Senator John McCain ahead of their primaries this month. And Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, says the campaign is not in a state of disarray. Joining us to talk about all this is NPR's Ron Elving. Welcome back, Ron.
Pleasure to be with you, Eric.
Ron, Republican strategists are reportedly furious at Trump over how he's handled his campaign since the GOP convention. I mean, this seems like more than a minor bump in the road. Is this break glass mode for the Republicans? And if so, what does that mean?
Things feel different, don't they? It just doesn't seem like the atmosphere we had in the convention leading up to the convention or even during the primaries when there were certainly lots of Republican critics of Donald Trump. But this feels different, and everyone is still trying to kind of get their arms around it. There were all the controversies over the weekend. Of course, the criticism of the Gold Star family, number one, but lots of other things, too, talking about the dates of the debates, saying he had a letter from the NFL when the NFL had never sent him one, saying that he had turned down a meeting with Charles and David Koch, the big Republican fundraisers, when in fact it was they who had refused to meet with him at the instigation of his fundraisers, and just lots of things that just seemed to be unforced errors and controversies that all swirled over the last 3 or 4 days.
Well, and we had today former Republican Congressman Vin Weber telling CNBC Trump's nomination was, quote, a mistake of historic proportions and a Trump win could cause markets around the world to collapse. I mean, many members of Trump's own party found his dispute with the family of a fallen soldier inexplicable. How does his campaign get back on track, Ron?
The first thing, perhaps, that Donald Trump needs to do is to get on to some other subjects that don't have to do with his disputes with other people, his disputes with other people who might not necessarily even be his enemies. His refusal to endorse Ryan and McCain, of course, is the first example. But he needs to start talking about something else. And I think his campaign today is going to start talking about other things that have happened during the Obama years, particularly with respect to the Iran deal. He's going to try to get back on the more accurate sort of targeting of Hillary Clinton, his actual opponent.
Well, switching to the Democrats, Ron, it seems like we've heard little from Hillary Clinton this week, with Trump again sort of dominating the headlines and the airtime. What issues is she talking about this week, and is anybody really listening?
She has been talking about her first 100 days plan to create jobs, calling it the largest job creation program since World War II. No, people have not been paying very much attention to it. It gets reported sort of dutifully, but alongside whatever remarks she makes about the unfitness or unsuitability of Donald Trump, which is getting all the attention. Obviously, President Obama said something very similar yesterday. That got a lot of attention. But it's mostly been Donald Trump's own personal behavior that has really dominated the news.
Clinton and Mike Pence campaign in Colorado today. What's at stake in that swing state, Ron?
There are three states west of the Mississippi that are true swing states, Nevada and Iowa being the other two. Barack Obama won all three in 2008. Hillary Clinton would very much like to have all three this fall. And Colorado is the largest of them, and it has a growing population of Hispanics, many of whom are just now getting around to voting for the first time. And that is what she is going to be focusing on. I think we can expect to hear Tim Kaine trot out some more of his Spanish, and they will be pushing very hard for that vote, but for the entire Colorado vote.
Never a dull moment in the 2016 campaign. Thanks a lot, Ron Elving.
Thank you, Eric.
Well, while Donald Trump continues to grab national headlines, let's turn to one of his former rivals, Senator Rand Paul, in what is our very first Senate tracker of 2016, our ongoing look into Senate races across the country, starting today with Senator Paul in Kentucky, where he's facing a challenge from Lexington Mayor Democrat Jim Gray. Ryland Martin is Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. He's with us from Louisville. Hi, Ryland.
Hi there.
And, of course, a lot of people listening to this, whether they're in Kentucky or anywhere else in this country, know about Rand Paul, who, of course, ran for president. He dropped out in February of this year, but he has not been a big supporter of Donald Trump. So what is he running his reelection race on in Kentucky?
Well, he's been running a very quiet campaign so far this season, and really he's kind of trying to run the same race that he ran 6 years ago, which is one based on fiscal responsibility, reducing the debt level in the country, and also just kind of there's this other criminal justice reform side of his campaign that seems to get a bit of attention, but he hasn't really been able to act on it so much in Washington, D.C. so far.
And is he talking about Trump at all? I mean, Rand Paul once called Donald Trump a delusional narcissist and an orange-faced windbag.
I mean, he's had to answer questions about Donald Trump, and he kind of provides these muted quasi-endorsements, you know, saying that he would, you know, he's not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and you know, saying that he and Donald Trump do have disagreements, but that he'll ultimately still support him.
He doesn't have any ads out right now, but a super PAC supporting him has this ad out against his opponent, Democrat Jim Gray, who is the mayor of Lexington. Let's listen to the ad.
Hillary Clinton will continue to wreak havoc on our economy.
We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business.
But crooked Hillary isn't alone.
I know that Rand Paul will try to tie me to Hillary Clinton, and I support her.
Jim Gray backs Hillary because they're the same kind of liberal, big government, coal-hating politicians.
Coal-hating politicians. What has Jim Gray's response been to that criticism?
Well, surprisingly, he hasn't been exactly embracing Hillary Clinton, but he's just trying to, you know, say that he's running his own campaign and that he supports coal. He had a press conference last week in which he outlined his four-step coal plan, which kind of involved inviting new infrastructure to be created in eastern Kentucky, trying to get new businesses to invest in the area, and also investing in some new forms of technology that would allow more carbon to be captured by these coal-fired power plants that are, you know, putting carbon out into the atmosphere. So he's been having a time, you know, trying to kind of dance around this connection to Hillary Clinton because she seems to be, you know, somewhat unpopular in Kentucky. Previously, most of the discussion in Kentucky, at least tying Democrats to federal politicians, who was always trying to tie politicians to President Barack Obama. And Hillary Clinton has kind of filled that point now. She seems to be not that popular in Kentucky, especially after that that one quote in which you just aired that she would put a whole lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business in Kentucky.
Although, and we've talked about this on the show before, that if you listen to that quote in context, she's saying something actually quite different from the soundbite that has been used over and over again. Let's listen to an ad from Jim Gray. It's called Listen.
I moved my office from the top floor to the first floor when I was elected mayor to hear people's ideas. I took their ideas and cut waste, turned a deficit into a surplus, and helped create thousands of jobs. I'm Jim Gray, and I approve this message. Because both parties have good ideas, it just takes someone to listen.
What more should we know about Jim Gray?
I guess the big headline about Jim Gray is that he's an openly gay mayor, and that's something that seems to attract everybody's attention to this race in Kentucky, especially being this year after our county clerk in Rowan County refused to issue marriage licenses to all couples after the Supreme Court ruling legalizing gay marriage. And the thing is that hasn't really become too much of an issue in this race. I think everybody would kind of imagine, you know, conservative Kentuckians running against Mayor Gray's sexual orientation. But really, it hasn't come up all that much. Neither Jim Gray nor Rand Paul seem like they really want to talk about it very much.
What do the polls look like, Ryland?
There actually hasn't been very much public polling in Kentucky. Last year, there was a bunch of public polling along with our gubernatorial election. But pollsters seem to be a bit scared of Kentucky now after last year's race, which showed the Democrat Jack Conway way in the lead over Republican Matt Bevin, who's now the governor. So everybody got kind of surprised by the incorrect polling last year, and there really hasn't been that much this year. Jim Gray has released a statement saying that they have internal polling showing that they are neck and neck with Rand Paul's campaign. they refused to provide the methodology on that poll, but that's all we really have going so far. I mean, definitely momentum seems to be in favor of Republicans in Kentucky these days. There's been more Republicans registering to vote in the state, especially at the federal level. Kentucky has been voting Republican year after year. The last Democrat elected to the Senate was in 1992. And also last time Kentucky voted for a Democrat for president was Bill Clinton's 1996 campaign.
That's Ryland Barton, Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio, talking to us about the Senate race there, where Rand Paul, Republican, is up against Democrat Jim Gray, the mayor of Lexington. Ryland, thanks.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And again, as our Senate Tracker series continues between now and Election Day, we're going to be checking in on Senate races around the country. We're also checking in on House races in our District Profile series, so stay tuned.
This week, R&B singer and musician Aaron Neville celebrates his 75th birthday with a concert at the Brooklyn Bowl in New York City. But this is no retirement party. After more than five decades in the business, Neville shows no sign of winding down. He's just released a new album.
I put her hand to my heart and said, don't you feel how it's beating? Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
It's Be Your Man off of Aaron Neville's new album, Apache, and he joins us now to talk about the album and his career. Aaron Neville, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Apache has a funkier, more up-tempo, shake-your-tail-feather kind of sound than your recent albums. Does it feel good to get the funk back a little, Aaron?
Yes, it does. I mean, you know, a lot of my solo albums were produced by different people that had their idea of what songs I should do and all, you know. And they had me doing a lot of ballads, you know, but I do all of it, you know. I worked with the Neville Brothers for 40-some years on the highway and up and down since I can remember, you know, funk from New Orleans.
Mm. So on this album, you're reclaiming the funk a little bit and some of the uniqueness of and the wideness of your musical talents.
Yeah, a little bit of it anyway. I mean, I've done like pop, rock, doo-wop, gospel, country, you name it.
Is it holding each other's hands? Making all kinds of plans. Never, never saying goodbye. Never, never making each other cry. Love is all the above. That's what love is.
Your sound is so unique. I'm curious your thoughts on how you developed it. I mean, how'd you find your distinctive musical voice?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, my brother Art had a doo-wop group. We lived in the Calio Project in New Orleans, and they would sit out on the park bench at night and sing harmonies, you know. Clyde McFadden and the Drifters and Pookie Hudson and the Spaniels and Billy Ward and the Dominoes. And I was always fascinated by the groups, you know. They had the bass singer, they had the guys doing the middle harmonies, and the guy doing the high part. Well, I learned how to do all of them, just not all at once. Maybe next year. And then I was a cowboy. I'd go to the movies and I'd see Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, and I was a Hank Williams fan. Jimmy Rogers. I was a Nat King Cole fan, and when I was about 13, I heard Sam Cooke. And that was a moment.
A big gumbo of influences with Sam Cooke bringing home the main ingredient.
Right.
You pay tribute to your hometown, New Orleans, on the tune Stomping Ground. Let's take a listen.
Cool.
I was born in the southern land. That's where I became a man. My roots were down in New Orleans. The birth of jazz and the voodoo queen. From the heart of Louisiana. My real love boom and Mojo Hanna. On the music of the streets,
like a live band and Indian beat.
You list a whole lot of folks on this tune, Aaron, including Dr. John and the late, great James Booker, the brilliant New Orleans pianist. All guys you played with, right?
Right. We grew up together. You know, the first time I ever went in the studio was with Mac Rabinick and Dr. John. Mm. And James Booker, he went to grammar school with me and Art and Charles. He went to high school with my late wife, Joelle. So, like, we would just, you know, he would come to my house sometime and give us a three-hour concert. He was, like, one of the best piano players I ever heard.
He was terrific and left us too soon.
Oh, no doubt.
So when you talk about hanging out all night at the Dewdrop, I mean, you lived that at one time.
Oh, yeah. Well, like, the Dewdrop was the spot, you know, like, Mac Rabinick would come in there, the police would come and take him to jail. He said, well, you better come back next week because Ray Charles going to be in town. I'm going to definitely be in here. That was the spot. Anybody came to New Orleans had to come to the Dewdrop.
Couldn't keep Dr. John or yourself away, yeah.
Oh, no.
You and your brothers, the whole family really is so identified with New Orleans, its history, its soul, but there's word you don't get back there as much anymore after Katrina. Is that true? And if so, can you tell us why?
Well, I go down for the Jazz Fest, and I haven't played a regular gig down there in some years now. I don't know why either. Every time I do an interview, they ask me that, so I told them, tell New Orleans to call me, and I'll come, you know.
Man, you hear that, New Orleans? Get on the phone. let's
yeah,
make
I love
it happen.
Playing there.
You're famous for your ballads, and this album has several great ones on it. Let's take a listen to one of my favorites, Heaven.
Cool.
How have you maintained your voice over all these years? I mean, nature's gift, or do you have some kind of vocal workout you can share with us?
I just sing every day, you know. I try to hit notes and, you know, because I've had problems with my throat over the years, you know, playing with a loud band for years, and I've had bruised vocal cords and nodules and all that, and I pray a lot, too. I think, you know, the Creator kind of renews me.
Prayer, meditation, and just practice?
And singing, yeah. Hmm.
Do you think your voice has changed that much over the years, or do you still have the range and control you had when you were a younger singer?
I'm getting it better now since I've been, you know, I'm living in a place in Pawling, New York, and no neighbors close by, so I can sing as loud as I want, as much as I want, and that helps, you know, to say you use your voice and it hangs around.
It's a little freeing not to have to worry about the neighbors, huh?
Right.
Another song I really like is Make Your Mama Cry. Has the line, trouble gonna run you down. Let's take a listen.
You give all trouble to your dear old dad, thinking you're the baddest man around. Soon they're gonna plant you in the ground. Trouble gonna run you down. Trouble gonna run you down. Revenge. Karma's gonna gun you down. Karma's gonna gun you down. When you make your mama cry.
So tell us about Make Your Mama Cry.
I could have been probably talking to the young Aaron on some of it back then, you know. Because a lot of the quotes I made in there, like my daddy used to tell me, he said, boy, you're going to wind up a lost ball in the high weeds. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know what he was talking about at the time, you know, but... Then I heard my grandmother say one time, say, I might be dead and gone, but the red ant's going to bring me the news. So, yeah, I think I was talking to young Aaron and my kids, and because I wrote that a long time ago.
Hmm. I'm curious, if you didn't end up as an artist and singer, what do you think you'd have done for a living? What kind of job?
If I wasn't a singer, I don't think I'd be here. Hmm. Serious.
Kind of saved you?
Oh, no doubt.
Your wife, Sarah, may have saved you a little, too. She's the focus of several songs on this album. There's Sarah Ann, Orchid in the Storm, even the tune All of the Above,
right.
Where you sing about what love is.
Yeah, she inspired me. You know, I can't sit down and plan to write anything. I have to be inspired, you know. Mm-hmm. And Sarah Ann was easy. Sarah was a photographer. She was doing a photo shoot on the Neville Brothers when we first went back to the Jazz Fest after Katrina. Mm-hmm. And I met her, and I fell in love right then, you know. And I thank God sent her to me.
You are my saving grace. I have looking in your pretty face. You suspect in my soul. Took me to heaven to hold. Oh, sweet Sarah. Oh, sweet Sarah.
So, Ann, you turned 75 this year. Paul Simon, who's also turning 75, has been saying, you know, he might hang it up, might retire after this tour, that he's done with the music business and industry. But you don't seem like the retiring kind. Am I right?
You are right. I'm not the retiring kind. I'm waiting till whenever the creators say, Aaron, break it up, son. That's it. Well, you know, until then, I'm as long as I can hit a note, I'm going for it.
So the touring, the hotels, it doesn't get you down. You still got the energy. You still want to keep going.
Yeah, but I'm still waiting on Star Trek to come up where they can beam me from my house to the gig and back.
Yeah, aren't we all? Aaron Neville, his new album is Apache. Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Same here.
Is there a tune from Apache you'd like to go out on, Aaron?
Fragile World.
Fragile World it is.
Cool.
Fragile world. Everyone's in the path. And no one's safe. Mighty wrath, tornadoes, earthquakes, and hurricanes.
One of the largest health care providers to participate in the Affordable Care Act says it is canceling its expansion plans and may withdraw altogether. Aetna made the announcement saying it expects to lose more than $300 million on its Obamacare business this year. Sarah Cliff is senior editor at Vox. She writes about health care policy, and she's with us from Washington. Sarah, why are they losing so much money on Obamacare?
So that part's actually pretty simple. They're losing money because the people that are signing up, they're sicker than they expected. One of the things that Aetna's CEO said in their earnings call yesterday is that the people who signed up in 2016 were sicker than the people who signed up in 2015, which means they have to pay more bills, that they're spending more money on their enrollees. And that essentially explains, you know, why they're suffering these losses, that they weren't able to predict the health of the people who were going to sign up, and they ended up with people who had worse health conditions than they were expecting.
Still, this is pretty significant because Aetna was seen as one of the few major providers of health care to really get behind Obamacare.
It is significant. We're now, you know, as the Wall Street Journal reported this morning, in a situation where the five major insurers in the United States have all reported losses on the Obamacare exchanges. You know, this doesn't mean that the exchanges are in a death spiral. I think it's far, far too early to kind of declare, you know, some kind of systemic problem. However, I'm sure, you know, the Obama administration would like to see the reverse. I think they would be much more pleased with the situation where these really big carriers were earning money and not be in the situation we are now, where you have all the major plans selling on the marketplaces, you know, reporting losses this year.
And is it possible that Aetna and other insurers that are facing losses because of their business in Obamacare will actually pull out altogether from Obamacare?
So we have seen United pull out almost completely. That United a few months ago came out and said, we've suffered losses. We're really not going to play on Obamacare in any significant way. It really remains to be seen with Aetna. As you mentioned, Jeremy, they have decided to not go forward with an expansion. They were initially planning to expand into five additional states. They said they're no longer going to do that. I think it'll be pretty important to watch on what happens to the 15 states they already sell in, whether they continue selling there or if they're going to pull out of some of those states, which would be much more disruptive. It would mean that, you know, some people there would have to find some new insurance plans.
And I guess the other question is, what would happen with Obamacare if insurer after insurer decides to pull out? Would we move more towards what a lot of the liberals wanted in the first place, which was more of a single-payer system, because that would be the only way to keep people covered?
So I think single-payer is still a little whiles off. You would need Congress to do something. It would have to be kind of a lot would have to change to get us to a single-payer system. I think, you know, what you could more plausibly see happening is you see some of the brand names we know, the people who provide insurance to, you know, people who get insurance at work, like Cigna, Aetna, United. They might become small players on the marketplaces. They might become non-existent because they really weren't equipped to sell to individuals. They're used to selling to really big companies. Mm. And you might see some insurers that, you know, those of us who get insurance at work are less familiar with. You know, these are insurers that have maybe worked with state Medicaid programs, that have more experience in the individual market. They might come to dominate the marketplaces. So you could see a shift in who sells. You know, that would mean, I think, Obamacare is doing okay. You have people who want to sell. The point where it would not be okay is if nobody wants to sell, and there really isn't a backup plan for that.
That's Sarah Cliff, senior editor at Vox, talking with us about the announcement from Aetna, the healthcare provider, saying it is going to pull back on its participation in Obamacare. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
For much of her early life, Celai Abrams believed she was the daughter of a Chinese mother and a white father. When she was five, her mother abandoned the family. Celai, her brother and sister were then raised by the man that she looked upon as her father. But growing up in California and in Florida, Celai always felt different from her siblings. Her skin was darker and her hair curlier. Then, when she was 14, her dad revealed the truth. Her biological father was, in fact, a black man whose name Celai would never know. For years afterwards, she struggled to figure out who she was in a world that often saw race in black and white terms. She writes about that struggle in her new book, Black Lotus, A Woman's Search for Racial Identity. And Celai Abrams joins us to talk about her book. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
As you write, from the very beginning, you looked different from your siblings. And how did your parents explain your darker skin to you?
The way that it was rationalized was because I was born on the island of Hawaii. I was actually born in Wailuku, Maui. And as a four-year-old, as a five-year-old, I took what my dad said at face value. I mean, I believe him when he said there was an Easter bunny and Santa Claus. Right. So right. It took me a little bit to figure out.
At what age did that explanation just stop making sense to you and you began to question and wonder?
I was around the age of eight. He was engaged to the woman who would become my stepmother, his second wife. Mm. And her family, she is white, and I just remember being at a barbecue at her mother's home and staring at the sea of people. And I couldn't understand what was this chill in the air. And it was a very strange, surreal moment. It just clicked. I looked down at my arms, and I noticed the skin color, and I looked at everyone else, and I said, oh, my God, I'm not like them.
Mm. And after your dad divorced your mother, Daisy, and remarried, there were these issues where he just wouldn't touch. I mean, you write, there were three things in our household we never discussed: Daisy, the Vietnam War, and race. Despite having four children of various racial compositions and skin colors living under one roof, three of whom were half Chinese, there was no mention of race or our Chinese heritage. Mm-hmm. Your dad just didn't want to go there.
No, he didn't. I mean, and I know he was enraged. Part of it was his own need to preserve his anger and resentment over the failure of his marriage, but also, quite frankly, it's what I, you know, refer to as the privilege of his whiteness, the fact that he did not think that race was an issue, given the fact that he had converted to the Baha'i faith from Catholicism. You know, Baha'is believe in one race, the human race, and encourage interracial marriages as a way to eliminate this divisions and strife that occurs over racial categories. So it was just something that he opted to ignore.
Mm-hmm. And he kept this secret from you. When you were 14, you and your sister were actually telling racist jokes from a book when your father almost casually made this revelation. He pretty much dropped it on you like a hand grenade and walked away. Tell us about that moment.
Yeah, so back in the day, back when I was a youngin', there were these books, totally gross joke books, version one, version two, and I was reading this one joke, my sister was, and we were cackling about it, and the joke was, how do you stop an N-word from jumping on a bed? And then the punchline was, you put Velcro on the ceiling. And so my dad was in the garage, which was probably about 10 yards away. So he came inside to get a beer. And as he passed by, he just said very casually, "I don't know why you're laughing, Salai. You're one." And he grabbed a beer, slammed the refrigerator door shut, and walked right back out into work on his Harley-Davidson. And that was it. So at that moment, you could have knocked me over with a feather, because here it is that I had been indoctrinated into this belief that to be Black was bad. And it was subtle. I would say at that age, at 14, it wasn't vicious. It was just casual racism, casual dismissal that a lot of people have. And it was like waking up in an alternate universe. You know, like one day, here I am. You're Black. Deal with it.
You write that the communities you were raised in were so very white, suburban California and then suburban Orlando, Florida. You write, "Everything I saw and heard was white, white music, white films, white TV shows, white neighborhoods, white little girls at my grade school, white family members after your father remarried." Were you at all aware of African-American culture, music, and history, or was that like a hand grenade too going off on you?
Well, first of all, Black history is not taught, you know, as extensively as it should be within the U.S. educational system. You learn about Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, George Washington Carver cultivated the peanut.
It was a very cookie-cutter view.
It was very cookie-cutter, but I think that that's something that, that continues. I think that's something that is still highly problematic. So, no, I had no knowledge at all. The only idea and concepts that I had around Blackness was what I saw on television, Good Times, which we didn't watch because that was a Black show and we were not a Black family. Whenever the Jacksons came on, we'd switch it to Donny Marie. When Motown songs would come on to the radio, my dad would switch it to the Beatles. I mean, it's just a very subtle conditioning, the way that you just completely immerse yourself in this white world. So no, I had no idea.
And you kept the secret from your friends. I mean, you became this rebellious punk rocker. But there's an incident you write about where an African-American basketball player came up and tries to talk to you. And you blow him off like, "What are you doing talking to me? You're not part of my culture."
And it ate at my soul because I knew I was lying. But I was terrified of what the consequences would be to me if people were to find out the truth. Because during my middle school years, particularly, I was exposed to almost daily vicious bullying because of the color of my skin, because of my name. The kids that I grew up with, because I was not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and because of the fact that I didn't have anyone around me of color to protect me, they went in for the kill. There were probably 20 Black students at the high school that I attended, and they stayed very closely together, but I didn't hang out with them because I wasn't Black.
You began to drink heavily. You left Florida for New York and worked hard to try to become a successful model. But alcohol kept derailing your ambitions. How much do you think your search for identity fed into your self-destructive behavior?
It's really hard to separate the two because addiction is a family disease. My parents, you know, there's, you know, on my mother's side, there's a long history of addiction. So, you know, when you start drinking at 13 years old and you're binge drinking and you're blacking out by 15, you don't know what's causing. Is it the chicken or the egg? Because the alcohol abuse is contributing towards your depression and all sorts of antisocial behaviors. And obviously, the self-medicating is not going to help you figure anything out. So I think it all comes together.
So, Lai, we know that race is a social construct. And we also know that it's a myth that we're in some kind of happy post-racial world. You're raising your two children. You very much want them to embrace their African-American identity. Tell us why.
I think it's incredibly important. One, for me as a woman who had to make a conscious decision to eliminate the Black inferiority complex, my internalized racism, and love myself. It was very important that my children never experience what I experienced. You know, they've lived a very different life, but I felt it was extraordinarily important that they embrace their Blackness. But there's a part in the book where I discuss how my daughter was identifying, self-identifying as multiracial. She'd say...
Right. She sort of says, this is your problem, Mom. I'm multiracial, part Chinese, part African-American. Get over it.
Yeah, yeah. She said, I'm a quarter Dominican, a quarter Chinese, and half black. And I'm just like, okay, first of all, like, you need to understand something. You may have all of these mixtures in your background, but society is going to read you as a black woman. And as she's gotten older, she's seen me speak around issues on race and domestic violence, as well as media representation. And she now identifies as black.
Salai Abrams, her new memoir is Black Lotus, A Woman's Search for Racial Identity. Salai, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
All this week, and really all year, Donald Trump has been dominating news cycles. Now, part of that is him saying what's on his mind, but part of it is just that he's been more available to the media this year than Hillary Clinton has. Here he is last week in Florida.
So it's been 235 days since crooked Hillary Clinton has had a press conference. And you, as reporters who give her all of these glowing reports, should ask yourselves why.
Well, joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And I want to play a clip of Joel Benenson, who is a Clinton campaign pollster. And last week he was asked about the campaign's decision not to hold press conferences. Here he is on ABC News.
She has done hundreds of interviews. She's doing them every week. You're setting up a standard that Donald Trump sets up of she hasn't had a press conference. We'll have a press conference when we want to have a press conference. There's no problem with that. But the American people hear from her directly every day, and she answers questions from journalists. She's been doing interviews for months.
And I should notice she just did a big interview with Fox News over the weekend. But where do you come down on this, the fact that she hasn't held a press conference in now more than 240 days?
notice the phrasing, we'll do a press conference when we want to,
yeah.
Right? It's not about when events warrant, when the people should hear her taking questions from reporters. I don't get as worked up about some people as some people do about the analogous question. Why doesn't President Obama have more press conferences? Why doesn't President Bush have more press conferences? I'm not always convinced those are the best forums in which you elicit the best answers to the toughest questions. That said, I think the American people deserve to have elected officials in whom they put so much authority and discretion to have them held accountable. And reporters are people often best equipped to try to do that, even if there's some preening and self-promotion involved. For Hillary Clinton not to take a press conference over the course of 6 months is pretty astonishing. Now, it's a question of her not wanting to do that. But I do think it's something telling about her comfort level and about the way in which she's decided to interact with the public. And I think it suggests a decent remove, even if she really has done these hundreds of interviews that they say, and so far I have not been able to obtain a tally of them or an accounting of them, that is a significant number of interactions with the press.
Well, and it also kind of plays into the strategies of both campaigns, that Donald Trump's strategy has been all along to always dominate every news cycle and be available. And as soon as he says one thing that people find offensive, he just goes on and talks about something else and it kind of changes the subject. Whereas Hillary Clinton, you know, we had David Axelrod, who was an Obama strategist, tweeting today, if I were Hillary Clinton, I might embark on a summer tour of America's splendid national parks and cede the stage entirely to real Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's not by accident that she isn't holding these press conferences. It's not by accident that she doesn't at least publicly seem to do a lot of prominent interviews. She's not doing the full Ginsburg, going on all of the Sunday shows at once except on rare moments. And when she does, in the Fox News Sunday interview that she did with Chris Wallace over the weekend, you know, she made these statements that seemingly are deeply inconsistent with what the head of the FBI said about the email scandal in questions. You know, she seems to raise questions every time she addresses questions, and that's a problem for her. She doesn't seem to be there doesn't seem to be a comfort level at this way of communicating with the public. She's running a much more conventional campaign of, you know, old school get out the vote, of social media, of things like that. And yet Donald Trump seems to be just doing this very different chaos strategy, which worked so well in the primaries and seems at least in this short bit of the general campaign quite self-destructive, leading to chaos not only with his opponent but within his own campaign.
David, while we have you, I want to ask you about another story, something that you've been covering very closely for years, and that is the sexual harassment scandal at Fox News. A lot more details coming out, it seems, by the day. Bring us up to date on where we are with that.
Well, obviously, so Roger Ailes is out, paid a lot of money to walk away, and we've been covering Fox News for years. But what was new, of course, was in early July, the sexual harassment lawsuit by former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson, which opened the floodgates. So this has raised the opportunity for other women to come forward, some of them by name, and say, Roger Ailes sexually harassed me too. In one case over the weekend, Gabriel Sherman, who's really led a lot of the reporting on this for New York Magazine, had this long interview with a booker who said over a 20-year period, Roger Ailes essentially required sexual favors from her in a clearly non-romantic relationship as she progressed up the ladder in various jobs at Fox News. And the relationship between her jobs and her sexual favors were as clear as day. Other people coming forward too, Lori Dew has said that she has some things to say, although won't quite specify exactly what they are. She was a longtime Fox anchor, let go some years ago. And now there's really a question of the culture. Were there senior executives at Fox News who were aware of this? It seems there has to have been if settlements were paid out, as is credibly alleged, for allegations of misbehavior by Ailes and others at Fox News, you know, the general counsel would have to know about these payments. The chief financial officer would have to know about these payments. There are questions about what Bill Shein knew. He's the guy over programming, which incorporates all of the famous opinion hosts at Fox News. But he's also seen as Ailes' number two. And he is helping Rupert Murdoch lead Fox News even now in the absence of its creative engine, Roger Ailes.
It's going to be fascinating to see what happens in terms of the leadership, because Rupert Murdoch is in his mid-80s now, and we'll see who
That's
comes
right.
in and whether they will have the same views that Roger Ailes did. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you so much.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.